Good afternoon. You are tuned into a Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 23rd of January, year 2018. I'm Jeff Brown. I'll be your host for today. We'll be playing at the Blue Lane Club. Troy Quinn will be here to highlight this weekend's symphony concerts. We'll talk with Becky Roth about Rock Juno's Spirit of Happiness. And we'll get a preview of this week's Juno World Affairs Council presentation by Philip Yoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin filed a lawsuit over the Back 40 mine project in federal court Monday. The tribe claims the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency failed to take responsibility for a wetland permit. If approved, would allow for the development of an open pit mine on a site that borders the Menominee River. The tribe is concerned about the environment, water, and damage to cultural sites. The tribe objects to the agency's decision to allow the state of Michigan jurisdiction over the river and asks the court to require the agencies to assume primary control. The tribe and grassroots groups are holding a community send-off Tuesday with leaders and youth who will be traveling to Michigan for a public hearing on the project. A northern Wisconsin sheriff's deputy who shot and killed a teenager on the Bad River Reservation will not face charges in the incident. Danielle Kading reports.
Two shots fired. I need EMS now.
That's Ashland County Sheriff's Deputy Brock Mirjanovich. The officer shot and killed 14-year-old Jason Pirro on the Bad River Reservation in November. Special Prosecutor and St. Croix County District Attorney Mike Niskus reviewed findings from the Wisconsin Department of Justice and said the officer's actions were, quote, justified by the circumstances he found himself in. The DOJ said the deputy shot Pirro after the teen lunged at the officer with a knife. Niska said the investigation shows Pirro called 911 from his home phone. A knife found at the scene was consistent with those in Pirro's home. The state's findings also show the teen had a number of what appeared to be self-inflicted cuts and the powerful opioid fentanyl in his system. Jason's family members recently protested the prosecutor's decision not to file criminal charges against the officer, including the teen's older cousin, Renee Pirro.
He had a taser on him. He had pepper spray.
He could have called for backup.
You know, he was so quick to bring the gun out and shoot, and I don't believe that that was right.
Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says they're among communities nationwide grappling with officer-involved shootings.
It's a subjective, life-changing thing for every community that, and every family that's got to experience it. There are deadly force scenarios that occur in law enforcement contexts. This doesn't rise to that type of scenario in my mind.
Wiggins says he wants the U.S. Department of Justice to honor the tribe's request for a federal review of the shooting. Ashland County Sheriff Mick Brennan declined to comment on the state's findings, but his office released a statement urging people to read the report. The statement went on to say his office is committed to restoring trust with the surrounding community. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
Leaders of Native organizations and tribes are continuing to keep an eye on actions by Congress and are reminding lawmakers to keep obligations to tribes after the three-day federal government shutdown ended after President Trump signed a funding bill. Jackson Brasi, the executive director of the Navajo Nation Washington, D.C. office, says the Indian Health Service, education, and safety are among top concern.
So we wanted to make sure that our students and the people that go to IHS hospitals are taken care of first. And then after that, we have public safety and police officers at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Any federal shutdown is a very big deal for the Navajo Nation and Indian country in general, and so we've been watching it very closely.
The bill funds the government through early next month. Brasi says his office will continue to advocate in the next 3 weeks, especially in areas of health care, including the special diabetes program for Indians, which is set to expire in March. Red Fawn Fallis entered a plea agreement this week with federal prosecutors. She's accused of firing a gun during actions in North Dakota opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. A serious charge with a long prison term was dropped. Attorneys will now recommend no more than 7 years for other charges. The Bismarck Tribune reports sentencing could take place in the spring. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation.
Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com. Support by the Herd Museum, hosting the 28th annual Hoop Dance World Championship, where you can see more than 70 talented native hoop dancers vie for the championship title February 10th and 11th. Details at herd.org.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
It's at 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into June Afternoon. I'm Jeff Ryan, I'm host for today. Our next first guest in the studio is Michelle Fabrillo, here to talk about Blue Line Club and the hockey games sort of with that such. Michelle, thank you for being on the station today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it.
So first question, why do they call it the Blue Line Club?
Well, if you've ever been to a hockey game, I think you should know the answer to that. It's where we always get our offsides. So the puck has to cross the line in order to continue in to the zone.
So that's why they call it the Blue Line Club, because the lines are painted in blue.
Yes, exactly.
What's the mission of the club?
Our mission is to raise funds for the Juno Douglas High School hockey team. And we need to raise about $90,000 every year in order for our kids to play hockey, to travel for equipment, for rental, for gear, and that sort of thing. But mostly it's for travel. We don't have any teams that we can play here in Southeast, so we have to go up north to play our games. And then to get our home games, we have to actually pay for teams to come down to Juneau.
How many players are there?
We have about 35 players on varsity and JV this year.
And you raise money by having events.
Yes. We have to have quite a few different fundraisings, and the one that is coming up this weekend is called Shots on Goal, and it's our annual wine tasting fundraiser. I haven't been involved with the fundraiser except for the last couple of years, but I think that we've had this event for probably 10 years now, and this year we are having it at the Baranoff. And it's going to be on Saturday, and it starts at 6, and we're going to have four distributors there that are going to be pouring beer and wine this year. So the beer is something new that we've asked them to provide, and they've been gracious to do that because not everybody likes wine, I guess. So we want to have a little bit of variety. With admission, we're going to have some great appetizers. We've got meatballs and pinwheel sandwiches and, of course, salmon spread. And let's see what else.
A whole bunch of stuff,
yeah. Chicken skewers. And also with admission is a free souvenir glass with our logo on it. And you get to take that home if you want to. And it's going to be a really fun event. Again, I don't know if I said it starts at 6. We're going to have pouring till 8. And then on top of that, we're going to have a great silent auction.
What kind of items are you having yet?
We have everything from helicopter glacier tours provided by Coastal Helicopter. We've got whale watching tours provided by Allen Marine and Gastineau Guiding. We're going to have some massages and a bunch of items from some of the different businesses around Juneau. We've got dinner for two coupons from the Hangar and Zerelda's, and we've got items from Trove, Wingnut Auto, Western Auto, Foggy Mountain Shop, Heritage Coffee. The list goes on. We're going to have some really great items this year from our local businesses.
How much time are the doors open so people can start bidding?
Well, you can start bidding as soon as you get there. We're going to have all of the auction items laid out on the tables so people can peruse, and the bidding can start right away, and it's going to continue through the night, and we'll see how it goes.
And it starts at 6?
It starts at 6, yeah.
Where do the teams go when they travel?
They go north, obviously. They go to Wasilla, Palmer, Anchorage, North Pole, Fairbanks, Big Lake, Houston.
That's a lot of places.
Yeah, yeah, they do. They try to get their games in, you know, and they'll go up one weekend and they'll probably play, they'll drive out to Houston and Big Lake, and then they'll play in Anchorage, and then they'll go up to Fairbanks and they'll play North Pole and different teams up there.
It must be hard balancing your hockey playing and the travel itself.
Yeah, it is a lot of work, and we've got a great group of parents and a great group of board members that help out.
Now, these players, when they spend nights somewhere, they don't go to people's couches. They go to hotels.
No, a lot of times they will stay in hotels so we can keep everybody together and keep track of their gear and nobody's losing their shin guards. sometimes they'll stay at the schools and they'll stay in the gym if there's room for that and there's nothing else going on.
Is there a way for people to contribute, even though they may not be going to the event?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're always willing to take people's money. They can definitely contact any one of the board members or myself.
Is there a website?
There is a website. You can get to that website through the high school link, I believe, the Juno Douglas High School website. You can find the link for the hockey team on there under the activities.
Now, you finished your games in Juno.
We have finished our games in Juno. We just finished our last home games last weekend. North Pole came down, and we actually won both of our games against North Pole. And then we got a special treat. Whitehorse was here, and they played our JV team. And the JV team actually played four games against Whitehorse, and I believe we won three and we lost one. And the team that came down from Whitehorse was actually also able to play some of the other JDIA teams, that, like the 14Us and 16-18Us.
As a parent, what makes hockey special for you?
Oh, it's just fun to watch the games and see the kids excel at their sport and get better every year. And also, like I said, it's a great group of parents, and it's just really fun to make that connection and just be part of that community.
And it's happening at the Baranoff. What are the days and hours, please?
So, again, it's going to be Saturday, this coming Saturday, January 27th. It's starting at 6. We're going to have pouring until 8, and then the event will continue until 9, 10 o'clock if people want to stick around, and we're going to do our silent auction. We'll probably have some door prizes as well.
Michelle Fabrillo, thank you for coming down to the station. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I just want to, again, thank the businesses in the community for all of their support. It takes a lot of effort from everybody to make sure that this is a great event and that we get all of our fundraising in. So I appreciate that.
Michelle, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
So that's 15 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Troy Quinn. He's the music director of the Juno Symphony. Troy, thank you for coming down today.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to see you again.
You just finished a radio show at KXLO.
I did. People are going to get tired of me pretty soon. I'm here all afternoon.
So your performances start Friday, or Saturday and Sunday.
They do, yes. And this time, Jeff, we are doing Shakespeare in Love as the theme of the program. So all music inspired by Shakespeare's literary works, which is a plethora of music, some of the greatest romantic music of all time. So we're sort of billing this as a wonderful date night pre-Valentine's. Bring your wife, husband, partner, friend, and come enjoy some wonderful music and some well-known themes from the beautiful Shakespeare canon.
What other pieces are you going to be featuring?
We are doing probably one of the most well-known pieces in the classical repertoire, Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture. And that has that famous English horn melody that everyone knows and loves, as well as the Romeo and Juliet from Nina Rota's film, the 1968 version directed by Franco Zeffirelli. So we've got two different versions of Romeo and Juliet, as well as some other pieces. Our youth concerto competition winner will be joining us, Kyle Farley Robinson, to play Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor, just the first movement, which is a gorgeous piece. So we're adding that to the program, and there'll be a few concluding surprises. It's going to be a wonderful evening of music.
When you were picking out pieces of music, are there a limited number of Shakespeare songs?
No, there aren't. Actually, we could do pretty much a month's worth of Shakespeare-inspired work. So the difficulty is, of course, choosing what goes on this program. So I try to choose things that not only the orchestra will be challenged by, but that the audience will be drawn to, and things that are familiar with us, too, as listeners. And I think we've accomplished that. We'll see come Saturday and Sunday. But it's always a difficult choice which pieces to include when the subject is so broad. And I think we've come up with a great program. You're also going to hear Mendelssohn's Wedding March on this program with full symphony orchestra, 60-piece musicians. So if anybody's thinking about popping the question, we've got a whole orchestra for you to do it.
I think that'd be unique.
Yeah.
Have you ever been so emotionally attached to the music that you started crying?
Good question. You know, the conductor has to really keep his or her emotions in check for the most part. Otherwise, things can fall apart. But I'll tell you, Jeff, I conducted the Romeo and Juliet Nina Rota version just last year at another symphony. And it did. I was very close to being so emotionally involved that I forgot what I was doing for a millisecond. And while that's wonderful as a listener, not great as a conductor, but this is a piece that has the power to do it, and we are playing it on Saturday and Sunday's concert.
One of my favorite parts of the concert is the pre-concert talk.
Yes, we have those going on before the concert on Saturday. Concert starts at 8, pre-concert talk will be at 7, and on Sunday the pre-concert talk will be at 2 with the concert at 3. And that's it's a very informal discussion with me, sort of like what we're doing here, but a little longer, about the insides of the music, what the composer was thinking, what you're going to hear, just to gain a little bit better appreciation, and just to come talk some trivia about the music and why we love to listen to these wonderful masterworks. And, you know, sometimes those topics go off not just on the music we're playing, but music in general or current trends, my career, you know, the symphony players, you know. And so it's a whole hodgepodge of stuff that we talk about, and it's really wonderful. So if you haven't been, come and enjoy an informal setting with me and the orchestra.
Is that something common in music, in symphonies?
It is, actually. A lot of orchestras do that, and in the other orchestras I conduct, I also give pre-concert lectures. This is a little bit more unique because we try to make it informal where people can come in even in the middle of it and ask questions. We want the audience to be engaged, and sometimes if there's a prominent part from one of the musicians in the actual work that you're about to hear. We'll bring them out on stage and play a little bit of that. So it's great. You kind of get a behind-the-scenes look and some of the insights, like I said, that you wouldn't normally if you just came and listened to it, which we encourage everybody to do as well. And I think it's going to be a wonderful precursor to Valentine's Day.
And if you're busy on Saturday, you can also catch it on the radio and propose to your sweetie that.
Yes, you can. Indeed, you can, Jeff.
What do you think Shakespeare would have thought?
Well, I think he probably would have thought, I didn't think there was going to be this much inspiration from these works, particularly Romeo and Juliet. We've got three pieces on the program that are Romeo and Juliet inspired. But of course, I think at the time, he probably wouldn't have realized that his music, his literary works were meant to be put to music. And I think he'd be happy about that.
Makes you happy.
It does. It's some of the most wonderful music ever written for the concert hall. And on wonderful stories. And what are most of these stories about? Love and tragedy. So you're going to get all of that wrapped in one in this weekend's concerts.
What inspired you to take up conducting as a profession?
Well, I'm a natural born collaborator, and I love the collaboration that happens with conducting. Now, of course, there's leadership involved, but I remember when I was young going to a John Williams dress rehearsal at the Hollywood Bowl. My parents took me to California on vacation, and I was 10 years old, and I remember him conducting the Raiders March. And I just thought, how cool is it that everybody is doing something that's contributing to this bigger picture? And I thought, oh, I could maybe do that one day. I had no idea about music. I hadn't even studied music then. I just liked it and thought, this is, you know, I can collaborate. I'm a leader, and that seems to be what the conductor does. And so, really, the power the conductor has is inspiring others, because I don't make a sound on the podium. So I have to
be...
Not. Yeah, exactly right. I have to be inspirational to my fellow wonderful musicians so that they will play their best, and that's the challenge I love about it.
What was your first instrument?
Voice, actually, was my first instrument. I began singing when I was 5 in the school plays and as a boy soprano. And then later I moved to piano and then conducting. So I started off as a singer, actually, a little different perspective from playing as a violinist or a member of the orchestra. And, of course, then once I realized, well, I have to learn about this and really get to know my stuff, then I studied a lot about the instruments of the orchestra. And not only that, but really watching the great people play and what works and what doesn't, and learning from watching our great artists.
I'm going to talk about Troy Quinn. He's music director for the Juno Symphonies. He had a concert coming up. He's conducting on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, tickets are still available at junosymphony.org, at Hearthside, and at the door. So get yours today.
Troy, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Jeff.
is bird note. Vermont field naturalist and writer Brian Pfeiffer writes today's story. It's an aster in winter, sun through the clouds, a force of nature called the yellow-rumped warbler. Discover this songbird's buttery warmth, even when life outside seems to groan or crunch or crack in the cold. By now, most warblers have migrated south, but the yellow-rumped warbler, which birders affectionately call Butterbutt, is a lesson in adaptation. In winter, when most of their kin are enjoying insects in the tropics, yellow rumps are finding food across parts of the West, the southern U.S., and north into New England. With insects in short supply, the yellow rump turns to fruit, juniper, viburnums, and mountain ash. But this warbler's greatest dietary feat is that it also eats the fruits of bayberry and wax myrtle, the raw materials of folksy candles. Digesting wax takes guts, literally. To do so, it appears that yellow rumps possess elevated levels of bile salts, which aid digestion of saturated fats. The yellow rump's gastrointestinal talents probably account for its ability to inhabit a winter range farther north than its relatives. Particularly along the Atlantic coast, birders, in a day, might find butterbutts in the hundreds, abundance unlike any wintering warbler in North America. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Did you miss our Midnight Oil podcast? It's not too late to take a spin with Alaska's Energy Desk through the highs.
People are like, do you really get paid for living there? And you're like, yeah. And you're like, dang, what'd I spend my PhD on?
And lows.
It really just happened to us. It was a classic boom bust. It was just classic.
Of Alaska's history as an oil state. Visit KTOO.org or subscribe to Midnight Oil wherever you get your podcasts.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, click, give. A great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
It's about half past an hour here. I'll tune into it in the afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Philip Yun. He's doing a speech in front of the Juneau World Affairs Council and a couple of presentations in Juneau as well. North Korea, bellicose tweets, and other nuclear challenges we face. Philip, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here in Juneau. It's been a while.
And you're a former U.S. diplomat.
Yeah, I was a State Department appointee under the Clinton administration from 1994 to 2001. Yes, and during that period of time, I actually, on the way to North Korea negotiations in Pyongyang, took a military jet, and we came here to Juneau, stopped over for fuel, and then we went to, was it Chimya Island as well? So I've spent some time here in Alaska. We had a long wait over here in Juneau, and it was the first time I'd been there.
Now, you've met with Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. It was Kim Jong-il at that point. So this was back in 1999. Yeah.
What kind of person was he?
Kim Jong-il, well, I think it was really interesting because back then we didn't have a lot of contact with North Korea. And I remember when we were meeting him, there was still a lot of mystery around him. And so the speculation was that he was a playboy, not very smart. And I think the general consensus among people in Washington to some degree was that he would not last very long, and that in fact turned out to be very wrong. He was very clearly pretty articulate, clearly smart. He watched CNN, watched a lot of television. He let us know a lot of what he saw in the world and was clearly up to speed on some of these issues that we were dealing with. I mean, there were talks on missile issues and talks on nuclear issues, and even though he didn't get some of the technical aspects completely correct, he understood what he was talking about and had some real depth of knowledge.
You're executive director of the Plowshares Fund. Tell me what that is. Can you describe it?
Yeah, Plowshares Fund, we're a public foundation. We've been in existence for over 36 years. We're based in San Francisco. We have a Washington office. And as a public foundation, that means we're supported by the public. And our mission is essentially to give find the smartest people with the best ideas, give them money so they can work to prevent and eliminate the threat of nuclear weapons. So that's what we do.
Is it it's a meaningful job? What makes it meaningful for you?
For me, it's great to be able to go to work every day trying to make the world a better place and a safer place, and to, in our situation, to make some concrete differences to make this world safer. One of the things that we did that we're known for was back in 2010 to help pass the New START Treaty, which reduced the number of nuclear weapons that Russia and the United States had from something like 2,500 to 1,500 apiece. One of the things that we did more recently was we were touted by the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times as being the hub and the center place of the domestic groups of people who were supporting and talking about how good the nuclear deal with Iran was for national security interests. And so I think in large part as a result of that, we were credited with helping that actually not get killed by the U.S. Congress back in 2015, I think it is, yeah.
I understand that we have a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
How do things develop? And for many, does it come down to just two egos? For many people watching this.
With respect to North Korea?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so there's people always talk to me about what the real threat is. And for me, when I think about it, the real threat, and this is something that I underscore, is not a preemptive nuclear strike by North Korea and the United States. That's not going to happen out of the blue. That is just people have to realize, and what's not discussed a lot is the notion of deterrence. North Koreans know and they understand that if they attack the United States in that way, they would cease to exist. They're not suicidal. So people have to understand that and realize that we are so much more powerful than that small little country, and we should not be as worried about it. I mean, there's more of a risk for sure, but that's something that we have to understand. What is a greater risk, quite frankly, is what I call miscalculation. You have an incredible number of military assets on the peninsula, 450,000 South Korean troops, 50,000 U.S. troops in Japan, 30,000 in South Korea, you have troops in China, not U.S. troops, but Chinese troops, Russian troops, a lot of military assets going around, especially when we have these military games that have been a cause of frustration and objection by North Korea. So what happens if you have a clash in the south and west, the east or west sea between fishing vessels, naval vessels over fishing rights, which has happened? What happens if you have a exchange of fire over the DMZ, which happened recently, or you have a North Korean missile that goes off course? What happens if one of those three causes a loss of life or property on part of the United States or South Korea or Japan? Given this high tension that's going on, exacerbated by Donald Trump's tweets, quite frankly, and some of our positions, I think that that's a real cause for concern. And if you look at the personalities of Kim Jong-un, he's known for being relatively inexperienced, for having a penchant for surprise, and being very aggressive. Well, I think arguably you can say the same for Donald Trump. And when you put that in the context of all the other things that are happening, I think that one spark could set the whole thing off fire. Now, it's not going to happen. I mean, it's not a certainty by any stretch of the imagination. But compared to 2 years ago, where I think the possibility of an accidental conflict was virtually zero, I think that it has definitely gotten a little bit bigger. So that's what we have to worry about.
Is there any way to talk about the differences between North Koreans and South Koreans?
Well, I think right now we are seeing some positive news, the fact that there is this peace initiative that's going on, the Peace Olympics. Things were very, very tense between the United States and North Korea and South Korea. And so I think that this is an opening. It doesn't mean that it's going to continue. The most critical thing is to take advantage of the opening. What I know about North Korea is never to get too elated and never to get too depressed, because things always change. And so in this circumstance, we have an opening, and the key is for the United States and South Korea to agree to have a conversation with North Korea. So the United States and North Korea have to, after this Olympics, talk about, have a talk about have a discussion about how they can ease tensions. If that's the case, then I think the South Koreans will be quite pleased because they are worried. They're worried about the interesting thing I just got back from South Korea is that the South Koreans have already calculated into their – they've already put Kim Jong-un into their calculus. What has thrown them or has surprised them is Donald Trump. And so the majority of South Koreans look at Donald Trump, interestingly, as more of a destabilizing factor than Kim Jong-un. You know, that could be some Stockholm syndrome or something like that, but it's an interesting dynamic that I noticed when I was there recently last month.
Now, Philip Yu is talking in front of the General World Affairs Council tomorrow at noon. Studios downstairs at the KTO Building 360. What are you going to be talking about?
So what I was going to talk about is what I think is going to be happening over the next 3 months related to sort of nuclear weapons-related issues. I'm going to be talking about a thing called the Nuclear Posture Review, which is highly technical, but it's on February 12th. The United States is going to release their new strategy for nuclear weapons. In other words, what weapons they want and how they're going to be used. And I think it's going to have a real effect on the risks of nuclear war, whether they're accidental by miscalculation or by malice. So that's one thing. I'm going to be talking on. We can expect something happening in May 12th. Related to Iran. There's a big decision that has to be made by the president as to whether to keep the deal or not. That's something that he self-imposed on him. And then to talk again about North Korea. Again, I think that if nothing is done in terms of follow-up with North Korea after these Olympics, we're going to get right back to where we were with high tensions. And I think conceivably another couple of tests and both nuclear and missile tests by North Korea. And that's something that we don't want.
You're talking in several different places. Do you know your schedule?
Yeah, talking. I love going to high schools, and so we're going to go. I've gone to this morning, this afternoon, went to a couple classes, because the young people are the future. They have to understand what all this means, and I think the nuclear issues this past year has come to the fore like none like in a generation. And so to get them informed and understand what the real issues are is an opportunity for me, which is great. I'm going to be talking at the, I guess, University of Alaska Southeast. Is that right? UAS?
Yes.
And then there's going to be a community talk with University of Alaska as well. So, and then a couple of other classes too. So this is going to be a lot of fun, and so far I've been enjoying it.
What kind of questions do the high schools ask?
Well, some of them are pretty basic. I asked them how many nuclear weapons there were in the world, and got some really interesting answers. Some of them, one person said 500, I think it was. Someone said a couple thousand. In fact, there are about 16,000 nuclear weapons right now. At the height of the Cold War, there were 70,000. And, you know, a few of those can destroy the world several times over. Questions they asked were, what's about North Korean motivation? Why are they doing what they're doing? They asked about the notion of deterrence. Some very interesting questions and very thoughtful, I thought, I observed.
What's your overall impression of what people understand about the problem and the situation?
Well, I'll have a better sense tomorrow. You know, understandably, the high school students, some of them had not done the I guess the module that was related to the Cold War nuclear weapons, but they were clearly informed and worried to some degree, you know, worried about North Korea. They've been following the news. And I think what sort of hit home for a lot of people is something that I'll touch upon is this whole Hawaii false alarm thing, right? You know, for 38 minutes, Hawaiians were told that there was an incoming ballistic missile and they didn't know what to do. And it just kind of highlights the notion that in this case, it was a clear accident where a worker pressed the wrong button. But one of the things I was asking the students to think about, well, that's one way it can happen. But what happens if you have somebody who is mentally unstable who does something like that, who presses a button? What happens if an individual hacks into the system or a country hacks into the system? And also to think about, well, it's one thing if it's Hawaii that this happens. What happens if it's the national warning system? Under that circumstance, what people that they didn't realize is that the president then has 10 minutes to decide whether to launch our weapons in response to that. and he can launch one nuclear weapon, or he can launch 1,000, which I think is equivalent to something like 18,000 Hiroshimas. And these are the things that can happen when that are a result of error and catastrophic error. So, these are the things that I'm talking about, which is terrible. But the good news that we at Plowshares Fund believe, and I think are an example of, we can do something about it and have a real impact. And I think, not to be immodest, that's why people come to us and invest in us, because we believe we can get things done, and we do.
Philip, thanks so much for coming down to the station. We'll be talking at noon tomorrow at the KTUO building for about an hour. And will you tell me, you'd be at UAS again?
UAS, we are going to be looking here at the community. I guess it's a community lecture, but I don't have the actual location, so we'll get that to you.
Okay. Thanks again for coming by. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you very much.
Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. Anyone has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You gotta wonder who they might drop one on. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You've got to ask yourself, who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb, has their own atom bomb. Just think of all the fingers and all of the triggers, and how every day the risk gets bigger. Someone, somewhere in the world, will use one of their atom bombs. You've got to ask yourself, who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? Just think of all the fingers and all of the triggers, and how every day the risk gets bigger. Someone, somewhere in the world, will steal one of those atom bombs. You have got to ask yourself, who gets to decide where, when, and why would anyone in the world want their own atom bomb? It ever came down that we were under attack, how many more of them would we fire back? Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb. You've got to ask yourself, who gets to decide where, when, and why? Don't you think it's time we put away our own atom bombs? Anyone in the world has their own atom bomb.
Tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guests in the studio are Becky Roth, Heidi Johnson, and Donnie Burris, here to talk about Rock Juno. Thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
Who wants to tell me what Rock Juno is?
I will. Thanks. Rock Juno stands for Raising Our Children with Kindness, and we're a diverse group of folks that are committed to a multiple-year effort to substantively improve the outcomes in 5 different areas for a healthy childhood for kids and young people in Juno.
How did we get started?
There were a number of us that were very interested in a framework called collective impact, which is a different kind of style or twist on collaboration, where really the walls and silos come down and people are gathering around an essential question, a complex social dilemma perhaps, or an environmental issue, to really substantively change the needle, if you will, on that effort or that problem area. And so this group of people, and I joined as the coordinator about a year and a half ago, we're really looking at how can Juno become a family-friendly, deeply involved and committed with a great united vision of what's great for a healthy childhood for young kids, all the way from infants, newborns, all the way to that launching age of young adulthood.
Did any of the genesis for this, was this coming from the kindness campaign that happened?
Actually, we got involved in forming Rock Juno before Lieutenant Chris Sell's efforts of kindness, which was last year, Year of Kindness. But we really felt like as that was closing out, 2017 was closing, we thought, what an opportunity. We already have a very activated community, very aware of what kindness is, and we want to continue it. We didn't think kindness should end when Chris left or 2017 ended. And so we were really interested in hosting 2018 as the Year of Kindness for Kids. So we're kind of using it as a platform or a launch for some of getting Rock Juno's name out and some of those efforts that we're working towards into the community, because kindness just doesn't go away.
Heidi.
Mm-hmm. So I'm with the Infant Learning Program through REACH, and I was invited here because this month Rock Juno is focused on infants and young families. And our program, we work with children ages birth to three and their families. And I think the philosophy that Rock Juno is using, you know, dovetails very nicely with our program. We really believe and come from the idea that if a child is well supported in their relationships and with their caregivers as well as within their community, we're going to see optimal development, both mental health-wise and learning and physical development. So a child's healthy development in Juno is really dependent upon a supportive community, and so it's really nice to be here and be part of Rock Juno.
Bonnie.
Hi there. So I'll talk a little bit about what we see for this Year of Kindness for Kids. And we're calling it YOKK, so Year of Kindness Kids. So like Heidi was saying, this month we're highlighting REACH, their infant learning program. But each month the idea is to highlight the efforts of groups in town, our programs and events that really cater to youth and healthy development of youth. So we'll highlight them every month, a different place, and there'll be an article in the Juno Empire in the Neighbors section and our column. And we'll write a little bit about those different organizations and youth groups and events and programs, and we'll highlight and celebrate what they do, as well as identify some gaps. And in identifying some of the gaps, we really would love, and we know that Juno will pull together and want to support those gaps and see how they can help and volunteer or donate so that we can keep this 2018 Year of Kindness going, just surrounded around youth this year.
Have you got any inspirations coming your way already?
So how many organizations are?
Sure.
Yeah, we're going to do, I think, one a month, so 12 throughout the whole year. And it's really exciting to go in. We'll do different sectors, so we'll have, like, elementary school, newborns, maybe kids with special needs, homeless youth. There are a ton of different groups we'd like to focus on. And anyone who wants to get involved or would like to know how they can help, they can reach out and look at rockjuno.org, and also look for those stories in Juno Empire. And also, we really want to encourage everyone, when they are inspired to participate in Year of Kindness of Kids, to hashtag Rock Juno, so that we can all share and celebrate with you. We understand that kindness is a very important thing in Juno, and people are doing it all the time, and we want to hear about those stories as well.
Perfect. Thank you. Perfectly said, Donnie. Thank you so much. Yeah, every month. So January was really focused on infants and newborns. February, we're going to focus on toddlers. So we're going to be reaching out to those partner organizations and groups that provide services and supports to toddlers and kind of highlighting them during the month of February. And then March, we roll into elementary age kids and what some of their specific needs are, as well as what we already doing that's so terrific in this town. This is a beautiful place to raise kids. I raised four of them here, and we're all looking sideways at each other. And what a wonderful community this really is, and we want to even make it stronger, deeper, wiser, and more compassionate. So we're just here to kind of raise the flag for kindness for kids this year and each month focusing in on a specific group.
How do you instill a sense of kindness to a toddler?
There's a lot of different ways, I mean, to provide. We're talking about not how toddlers can be kind to other people, but what can we as an adult and in the community support toddlers? So, for example, having wonderful developmentally appropriate toys, reducing screen time or media time, that imaginative play, for example, having activities and outside time, and most profoundly is having just good, healthy family time. So this is a great opportunity for me to mention on our website, rockjuno.org, we have a list of 118. We tried to think of 2018, but that was a really big list. We have a list of 100 plus 18 ways that adults can show and be supportive and kind to young people. So we really want you to go check that out on our website.
What are some examples?
Well, I just gave you a few. Help me, ladies.
I'm just thinking about specifically infants and newborns that might be entering our community. And we know that people in Juneau sometimes don't have family support or surrounded by caregivers. Mm-hmm. And so specifically, you know, a community activity might be for people to think about their neighborhoods. And is there a new baby or a young family in the community? And are there little things that you might be able to do to support that family? It could be shoveling their driveway or offering to bring a meal. Any little gesture or connection that you might have for that family will ripple into the family. And so not to feel like it has to be a big endeavor, but just think locally and what's happening in your community that you might support young children to be happy and healthy within their families.
Exactly. What's within your reach? If you know a family that has a newborn or a young person in the family, maybe helping with a sibling or with siblings, donating diapers, dropping off a dessert or just a little snack for the family to share, to offer just to sit with a new mom and maybe not even offer advice or direct support, but just sometimes standing next to somebody that's going through a difficult transition is a beautiful thing. So it's often just the gift of time.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Anybody else want to add on to that?
Yeah, I just want to let everyone know if you want any other information about the Year of Kindness 2018 for kids, you can go to rockjuno.org. And if you or you know someone that had an act of kindness this year towards kids, we want you to hashtag that on Instagram and Facebook. You can just hashtag Rock Juno, and you can look for us on Facebook and Instagram on Rock Juno. We want everyone to keep the momentum going from last year, and let's spread the love and kindness to our kids this year.
Exactly. Thank you.
I would thank Becky Roth, Heidi Johnson, and Donnie Brewis for coming down to the station. I want to repeat that website once more, please.
rockjuno.org.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, we really want to feel like this is a growing community in terms of our own compassion and our ability to reach out and increase connection and support for one another. So even though it's cold and chilly out, reach out and touch someone near you and offer them all the support you can, especially our kids.
Thank you for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Jeff.
Come hear how great composers from the concert stage and screen have reinterpreted Shakespeare's literary classics. Join me, Troy Quinn, and the Juno Symphony as we perform ravishingly beautiful music on January 27th and January 28th at JDHS. Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture promises to have you on your feet as the orchestra indulges in Nino Rota's iconic love theme, A Time for Us, as well as music from the movie Shakespeare in Love and Youth Solo Concerto Competition winner Kyle Farley Robinson. Tickets are at Hearthside, the Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
Do you like your country and rock, your folk and your blues, all in the same sound? Or do you like your music independent, honest, real, with blue-collar roots? Tune in to Southern Exposure Friday nights at 7 for a unique blend of Red Dirt, Americana, Outlaw, and more with me, your host, Red Stewart. At Southern Exposure Friday nights at 7 on KRNN-FM Juno, music and arts from Alaska's capital.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.